What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. This week, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to take a break from TBRCon 2023 panels and instead share with you the audio of a live author roundtable on how SFF is changing. This panel featured authors Shauna Lawless, Rob J. Hayes, Shui-Ting C. Ni, and Moses Osayutomi. And it was so enlightening to hear these four authors explore how the genres have changed over the past 5 years, the rise and decline of certain subgenres, the role of movie and TV adaptations in popularizing SFF, social media, self-publishing, ebooks, and much more. I hope by providing the audio of this roundtable here on the podcast feed will allow all of this incredibly valuable information to get out there into the hands of as many authors as possible. So, grab your notebooks, sit back, and enjoy.
Hello, everybody. My name is Shauna Lawless, and welcome to the podcast. Today we are talking about the genre of science fiction and fantasy and how it is changing. So hopefully we're going to have lots of opinions and lots of thoughts. And for anyone who is watching live, please comment and we can answer your questions or talk about some of your thoughts as well. But before we get started, I'd really like everyone on the panel to introduce themselves. Talk a bit about your background and your work, and then we can get started into some of the questions. So Moses, you are on my right, so do you want to go first?
Sure, yeah. My name is Moses Osayutomi. I'm a Nigerian-American. I'm based out of Hawaii, and I write almost exclusively fantasy. Every now and then I dabble in sci-fi, short stories and things, but I write mainly fantasy novels. I have a novel out, a young adult novel called Daughters of Oduma, and I have an adult novella called The Lies of the Ojungo. Both are African-inspired, one West, one North. And yeah, I tend to write fantasies with characters who don't really understand their world and they're trying to figure it out.
Okay. Brilliant. Okay, Rob, do you want to go next?
Sure. I'm Rob J. Hayes, British fantasy and sci-fi author. I have many, many books. I think I'm closing in on 20 at this point, which is kind of ridiculous. I actually have my 10th anniversary publishing just this month. So I've been at this for a very long time. But I'm probably most well known for my Asian-inspired martial arts romp, Never Die, and my dark epic fantasy, Along the Razor's Edge.
Perfect. And what about you, Shui-Ting?
Hello, I'm Shui-Ting, and I'm a writer and translator. I have a book out called Chinese Myths, a nonfiction book about, all about Chinese mythology. Previously, I published a book on the culture and social history of Chinese gods. And a couple of years ago, So I have an anthology that's already out, Chinese science fiction, which I've curated and translated, and I'm working on a horror, contemporary Chinese horror anthology. This might all sound a bit random, but this is because I tend to write about Chinese culture as a from different perspectives. So it's different facets of what I do. So I tend to alternate between fiction and nonfiction. And I'm a British Chinese writer, so yeah.
Okay. I ran into you at FantasyCon last year, and you won an award, isn't that right? Was it Best Translation?
I remember meeting you. Yeah, I did. It was a Best Anthology for Panopticon, yeah.
Yeah, you did a fantastic speech. It was really wonderful to listen to. Thank you. I think if you want to listen to your speech, it's on YouTube somewhere. And I would tell anyone to go and listen to it. It was very inspiring. I've seen it on YouTube.
Thank you. I thought there were quite a few kind of, I had some strong thoughts and I thought maybe I should share them because And then actually a lot of people resonated, so I'm glad if it helped to encourage people to, you know, to keep going. So
exactly. Yeah, it's definitely a big message to keep going, because it's not easy in this industry always.
Yeah, it's been interesting recently. Yeah, I think it's changing. I think that people haven't stopped wanting to read. Perhaps they want to read more now. So that's a good thing. It's a positive kind of development. Although how publishing works has changed a lot in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I suppose that's something that we're going to talk about during the podcast. It's not just about how the genre and the books are changing. It's also how the industry is impacting the books that we are reading and the books that are being published. So lots of things that we're going to talk about today. But I suppose if I'm going to start it off, if we're going to think about how science fiction and fantasy is changing, we need to have perhaps a little discussion about what fantasy is to each of us, what it has meant perhaps from childhood. So those original thoughts and feelings about fantasy and science fiction literature, and why it's something that has interested us. So maybe we can talk about kind of the gateway books or any sort of original literature that we read that has started us off on our path. Rob, how about I start with you this time?
Sure. I mean, to me, fantasy has always been escape more than anything else. Ever since I was a very young child, I've always loved to just run away and escape. It was always like if I was in social situations or whatever, I'd sometimes just be sat there staring out of a window, just dreaming dragons and whatever. Just it was always just a way to remove myself from the situation. And with reading, I think I just sort of found the love of escaping to an entire new world. I remember I think the first fantasy book I ever read was actually one called The Dark Portal by Robert Jordan. Was it Robert Jordan? Robin Jarvis. That's it. I think names. And it was about it's a fantasy story about mice and rats in this, almost in the vein of sort of Redwall. I was ill, and my mum just sort of like brought this book home from the library, and it was the first book in the series, The Dark Portal, and I read it, absolutely loved it, and immediately begged her to get the other ones as well, which she did. And it just sort of like that was my gateway into sort of like fantasy for me. It was very much the first time I was like really seeing a whole new world presented on the page, not just like his earth, but here's something going on in it that you've never seen before. Here's an entire new world with, in this situation, rats and mice as the characters. But yeah, it's always just been a way of escaping for me. But I think as I've started writing fantasy myself, it's also a way of exploring ideas that I possibly wouldn't have before, but in quite often exaggerated ways, to try and make them more impactful, I guess. And it continues to be a method of escaping. If there's something I don't want to do, I just run away to one of my own fantasy worlds and start writing these days, which happens a lot, much to my wife's annoyance.
Well, there's just so much to escape from, I think, in modern life. You know, it's
there certainly is.
It's been a strange 5 years, I think, for a lot of people. Okay, what about you, Shaiting? Do you want to talk about kind of where your original kind of inspirations in fantasy science fiction literature came from?
So I think for many of us, it hasn't necessarily been a book to start with, although there have been many books too. So for me, I came to it from a circuitous point of kind of way, although it depends on how far you go. If you go as far as like when I was little, then it would be things like Transformers or She-Ra. the kids cartoons, you know, childhood cartoons. And then I sort of forgot about it. I mean, and then it was the Star Trek and X-Files during my teenage. And then I sort of forgot about it and like really got into classic Anglican canon. Then it was when I was at university that I met lots of people and they kind of introduced me to it and reminded me of the cool SFF. And then I started reading lots of like classic kind of era English sci-fi, then more recent stuff from there onwards. So there is the, I remember very well the classic, the English classics like Shelley, Wells, you know, and Stevenson. They're always my favorites. Then there is the, I think from that era of 50s into 70s, I can always return to like Asimov, Wyndham, and Butler, Bradbury. So it's kind of, it's been a strange journey in a way. And now I think I'm catching up on, I think when I was reading lots of sci-fi, when I started reading lots of sci-fi in book form, there weren't a lot of science fiction or fantasy by diverse authors, and now there is more, and I'm kind of catching up on people who are kind of from similar backgrounds to me. I'm rambling on, so.
Oh, no, don't worry. Plenty of time. And I would say your experience is probably like very normal, where like you're watching cartoons that are fantastical and you don't think it is science fiction and fantasy, like maybe until you're older and then you start to read other books and then you're like, oh, I always did like this, but it was packaged as something different. It was like mainstream entertainment versus a genre, like literature, you know, like Lord of the Rings and things like that. So no, that's interesting. And what about you, Moses? Where did you start off on your SFF journey?
I think it was, oh, should I mention real quick for those wondering who are listening, Kritika had a bit of an emergency. She's okay, but she might not be able to make it. She maybe won't. I think that's the status right now. But I think what Rob was saying resonated with me, because I feel like I had two different entry points into the genre. One was as a reader and then one was as a writer. They were slightly different, where as a reader, I think when I was like 12 or 13, for Christmas, my brothers got me Dragons of Autumn Twilight, the first Dragonlance, or in my brain, the first Dragonlance book. And that was my introduction to like the genre as a reader, I think. You know, I'd read fantasy books before then, but this was the first one that felt like it was adult. And it was very, very fantasy in a way that I like my brain couldn't ignore. And so, yeah, I devoured it. I was obsessed with it. I read the whole series and all the adjacent books. And that was like my birth as a geek into the genre. And then, and I wrote after that, like I was into writing it, but I was trying to just recreate what I'd read as opposed to invent something that was me. And it was when I read The Once and Future King by T.H. White, also fantasy, but very psychological, very cerebral, very much more subtle. It's less grand adventure and more, you know, character study. And so that's when I was like, oh, this is the kind of stuff I want to make, not just consume. And that was really kind of a second rebirth or whatever in the genre.
Yeah. I think a lot of us probably start off the same way, where we're paying homage to the things that we've just read and enjoyed, and it takes us a little while to find our own voices and kind of the parts of the stories that interest us more than the others. If I talk like very briefly just about myself, like I grew up in Ireland, and there's so much Irish mythology here that even though it's not, you know, it's not fantasy, but it is magical. And so you're surrounded by lots of these stories. And then I think when I was 11, my brother gave me Lord of the Rings, which I just really, really loved. And I actually read it again when I was 14, and it was like reading a different story. Because it was obviously things when I was 11 I didn't quite get. and that I got more than when I was 14. And I read it again, like probably when I was about 18 as well. And it kind of, you discover new things. And I think for me, I really enjoyed the aspect of Lord of the Rings, where when I was doing sort of a bit of background research, people said that Tolkien was kind of using his World War experience, especially like when the dead bodies were in the marshes, and it was, I suppose, reminiscent of life in the trenches. And so for me, that was really interesting at how you could talk about real world issues, but in a way that's more abstract and perhaps more palatable. And so you can talk about these big themes without necessarily being too hard-hitting and allowing people to observe those things themselves, maybe. But I would also, just as a question, whenever you started to get into fantasy and science fiction, were there lots of people around you that were into it, or was it kind of something that you enjoyed, like you felt mostly on your own enjoying?
I think I only would have enjoyed it because it was just something I was into. I think if a bunch of people were into it, knowing me at that age, I would have been like, oh, it's probably lame. But the fact that like it was just like a me thing, and I actually, you know, this is pre-internet for me, so I didn't have other people I could go to. It felt like each book I was reading, I was the first person on earth to read it. And it was like, so in terms of escapism, in terms of like moving away from reality, it was the ultimate experience of like being reading books that nobody's reading, being in a world that nobody's been. It was so separate from everything else in my life. I think that was part of the appeal.
Yeah. And what about you, Rob? How did you find kind of talking about SFF with other people?
In terms of sort of like other versions of the media, like TV shows or like tabletop D&D and whatever, I had people around me that were always sort of like that version of geek as well. You know, I've always had people that were playing, D&D or Games Workshop games, you know, Warhammer, all those sorts of things with me. And yeah, there's always been people that you know, friends and the like that were watching like Buffy or stuff like that. Or back when I was a kid, like my dad used to bring home films like Willow, which we'd all sort of like watch as a family. But as far as books are concerned, I never really had anyone I knew who was reading fantasy as well. My dad read a little bit of sci-fi, but he was mostly sort of like non-fiction books. My mum exclusively read non-fiction, and I don't actually remember like my sisters reading at all or anything like that. But then as we've all grown up, I've discovered that my sisters do actually love fantasy, which is great. My mum's recently got into it as well, which is wonderful. But yeah, as a kid, and sort of like grown up until, I don't know, sort of mid-20s, I never had anyone to talk to about the books that I was reading. Because as Moses said, like the internet didn't really, but did exist, but not like it does now, where you can go and find a forum and just chat to people about books or whatever.
My son, he's 9. We were having a conversation, and at one point he just suddenly realized that YouTube didn't exist when I was a child. And he was like, what? Like, you did have YouTube? And it was just like absolutely mind-blowing to him that I didn't have the internet or YouTube and couldn't just watch TV shows on demand. It was just, my childhood is a complete, I may as well be like a dinosaur. It's just so long ago. They can't imagine it.
You used to have to connect to the internet, and your phone would just scream at you for like 20 seconds going, that's crazy.
I know. They just can't imagine it. But yes, I suppose that's one of the big changes is that I have found myself with enjoying SFF is that the internet has allowed communities to come together and to find each other. And so suddenly there's these huge fantasy and like science fiction communities, huge fan bases that have been so scattered until now. And so it's just a much bigger community than I had ever really realized, which is lovely. So we're meant to be talking about where the future like of SFF and where it's going. So we've talked a little bit about the past. So I was going to start to talk about the present. So like, where are we at the minute? And by present, I kind of mean possibly like where we are and what's happened in the last 3 years. Kind of what's happening with the genre. So if I ask you first, Shui-Ting, like what do you think has, what's happened in the science fiction and fantasy world? Has it got bigger? Where do you see, what genres, even subgenres, do you think have like kind of risen to the top in that time?
Yeah, I think it's definitely got bigger. Partly because of the pandemic, people are reading more, and partly because of the kind of this quite widespread awareness of the non-Western centric, non-European, US centric worldview. So publishers are kind of buying more books, or people are reading more books from other cultures, writers from other cultures, or kind of works drawing from kind of other cultures. So it's been, I think it's definitely got much bigger and more varied. In terms of genres, I'm seeing a lot of blending of genres, so a lot more subgenres, I guess, whether it's like sci-fi with mythology, or like horror, science fiction, and there's maybe Asian inspired fantasy, or Arab culture inspired fantasy, all kinds of things. So yeah, it's a really positive development, and that's why I've had the opportunity I've had to publish a Synopticon, because I actually started translating when over 10 years ago, and there weren't that many opportunities then. I wanted to, because I saw the kind of emergence of genre fiction in Asia and China at the time, and what, you know, people weren't really ready for it, but they are now. So it's a great thing for people like me to be able to get the opportunity to bring authors over from other cultures, because I am a nonfiction writer and a translator. So my voice is that of the curator, editor, and the translator. So yeah, so it's really great and of course seeing people draw from kind of Asian cultures. So people I've talked to saying, oh, really looking forward to reading the book, because it's your book, because I'm interested in writing some Asian based fantasy, or yeah. So I'm straying off topic again. I'm seeing lots of blending of genres, and which, you know, I've curated as well, some of them in my new anthology.
I definitely agree. I think for me, possibly having all those big fantasy movies and TV shows probably initially really helped publishers realize that there was interest and that it was a genre that sold. And as such, they've been more willing maybe to explore beyond the norm. So I have definitely noticed in the last like 3 to 5 years, different backgrounds in the story. So not just always Western European sort of type stories, which has been brilliant. And also the rise in subgenres. That's another thing I know, because I write historical fantasy. And maybe just because I write that genre, I have noticed that that's had a bit of a boom in the last few years that maybe hadn't had before, which is fascinating. If I ask you, Rob, because I know you have an indie background, and indie fantasy and science fiction has massively took off. And so what are your thoughts there? Like, what has happened in the indie self-pub industry in the last like 3 years that has sort of changing and brought momentum
Yeah. Well, it's grown a lot, to be honest, in the past 3 years. I mean, the amount of people who are willing to actually read indie for a start is booming, which is wonderful because it actually means that, you know, we can actually make a business out of this. We can make a living out of it. But it is also giving rise to a massive amount of variation within the industry. I think that we're in a sort of like almost like a golden age of the variety of stories that you can get. So, you know, if you want, hey, I want a zombie fiction set in Napoleonic France, there is a book for it these days. You will find it. You know, if you want a one that's like, I want a book that's a computer game, you know, lit RPG, it's an entire genre that exists nowadays. It's massive. So I think that basically what's changed, especially in the last sort of like 3 or 5 years or whatever, is these sort of like, there's lots of little emerging genre subgenres like lit RPG, like progression fantasy, like, you know, historical or urban, or but all of them, they're all just sort of like, they're all getting a boom, and there's just a lot more of everything. There's a lot more variety, which I feel is absolutely wonderful for the genre, because it gives you a way to like, I have this crazy idea, I want to write it, do it, and you know, then you can publish it and people will read it, which is, it's yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah, I think people are definitely willing to take risks and chances on new subgenres and books like never before, which is wonderful. That's one of my favorite things about the indie space, and trad, because both are growing, is that we are getting just things that are so different and are kind of pushing boundaries. Moses, what about you?
Yeah, I think everything you all said makes perfect sense. I think the internet has really just changed a lot. I mean, kind of what you were both speaking to is that, like, if you're a writer and you want to write Napoleonic zombies, like, you can access that reader now. Like, you know, pre-social internet, that was really difficult, you know. It made a lot of sense, I think, for publishers, indie and otherwise, to just churn out like Conan the Barbarian clones, because like, you knew there was an audience for that, whereas you weren't sure, you know, how would you even find that person who's really into that particular niche? Whereas now, you know, that person, there's a whole Reddit forum probably, or a Reddit thread for that. So I think that's changed things. I don't know at what point, like, I don't know what the genesis of this was. I think about the TV show Lost and how that was like a major network show with speculative elements that, you know, prior to that, it wasn't, you know, we had like Sci-Fi Channel and things like that. I know Comic-Con, I think for people who are younger and like see Comic-Con now and think like, oh, what a cool convention. It was not always considered a cool place to be. It was considered a place for nerds. You were not getting models and celebrities. That was not happening. So we're definitely in a different space. And I think kind of what Shui Ting was saying is that, like, one, at least the space I'm in, I want to qualify this, that it's such a big genre, science fiction fantasy. It's such a huge, enormous beast. I probably see like 5 to 10% of it. You know what I'm saying? Like, with Rob has a lot more experience in indie, and like Shui Ting has experience in like the Chinese aspect. I probably have this sub niche of like non-Western authors I'm into that I have no idea to what extent that represents the whole. So I don't want to pretend like I know where this beast is going or where it's at. But from what I see, there's definitely a much larger appetite for fusion of content and of culture. Way more books with authors from different backgrounds, internationally especially. Way more books that are blending literary tools into the space in a different way. I think there was like this, you know, I'm not as well schooled on the classics perhaps as Shui Ting is, but I know like there was some literary sentiment in like the early classics. And then I think at least when I was growing up in the late 80s, 90s, there was like the D&D domination of the genre. And I think now we've, at least in my, again, subsector, like I'm seeing a lot more just different tools being used to write. Not always as plot driven. I prefer plot driven. It's no knock on it, but we're just seeing different styles of writing that are also getting their time in the sun, which it's just cool to see.
Mm-hmm. Do you think like SFF would have like a scene as genre, like a genre fiction, and sometimes seen as like a lesser type of fiction? Do you think that stigma is still there, or do you think it's just completely gone now?
I think it's definitely there among certain people. I mean, you know, everybody's a snob for something. You have something that you're like, this is the pure version, everything else is trash. I think there's definitely people who still look at it as like, you know, the playground version of serious literature. But I mean, the New York Times reviews, we have Amal Makhtar, who's regularly reviewing like science fiction, fantasy in the New York Times. Like there's like Plowshares and the Missouri Review accept stories that have some element of speculation. I still think there's, in many people's minds, especially in like the gatekeepers, maybe there's a slight difference between like proper literature. But I think for readers, those boundaries are a lot more dissolved than they used to be.
Yeah. What about you, Rob? How do you feel? Do you feel that kind of snobbery is still there, or do you find it's beginning to like dissipate?
I think it's still very much there. I think that for probably a wide, if not the vast majority of the public or readers, it's still very much there. They just may not. I think a lot of them, they don't realise that they are consuming fantasy. So they still think of fantasy as like, it's fantasy, isn't it? It's not real. But then they'd be willing to actually watch it, but they're just like, you know, when it comes to sort of like reading, they're sort of like, there's still this idea that they feel that they have to read something with worth, and they don't feel like fantasy has much in the way of worth, which is ludicrous. I think that, you know, fantasy and sci-fi in many ways are sort of pushing boundaries, which a lot of literature isn't willing to. But yeah, no, I feel it is still very much there, but I feel like the readership in general has gotten so large, partly due to, I guess, the population of the planet has gotten so large that while fantasy and sci-fi is still quite a small percentage of the sort of like the main readership, it's large enough now that it can't really be ignored. So even though these, you know, this sort of like slight snobbery does still exist, I guess, it's not. It still exists within some spheres, but the problem is like when the market's that big, when the readership is that big, it takes over, and you end up living in a bit of a bubble. So I live in a fantasy bubble where I don't see the snobbery that much, but then when I look outside the bubble, that's when I start seeing it again, basically. Yeah, I do still think it exists, but I think it's getting much easier to ignore that it exists by staying within the fantasy community, because that's what one of the things that the internet has done for us. It's allowed us to create communities of people that we get on with, that like the same sort of things that we do, whereas before we hadn't really been able to do that quite so well, because it was like, well, it's this idea of where do you go to meet people who like the same thing that I like? Whereas now it's the internet, you just go on Reddit and go, oh, our fantasy, there we go. Suddenly there's a massive community of people that aren't snobbish towards fantasy in any way. They're there to talk about this thing that you love.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's what I have found as well. So there is that thing that you're in a bubble and you're maybe just not hearing the negative comments so much anymore because you don't have to. But I think probably they are still there a bit. What about you, Shaiting? Like, how do you find fantasy and SFF is being received at the minute? And, you know, is there a snobbery there that you're finding, or is that gone for you?
I have a lot of comments on a lot that's been said. But anyway, yeah, definitely is still there, unfortunately. Yeah, it depends on, I agree that it depends on which circle it is that you're in, probably more so in some than in others. And I am part of many different social groups, so like academia or like the mainstream, and then I have my geeky friends. I have become a geek myself. And then I have like these alt subcultures. I'm part of some old subcultures, and these groups are a lot more, you know, it's completely the norm for them, SFF. But then I still talk to people in others kind of part of my university who say, well, I just don't like sci-fi. It's to do with robots and spaceships. So it's like the difference is very, you know, it's like a black chalk and cheese. It's, you know, very different. So, but I think that the readership has expanded so much now, and a lot of sci-fi has got into the mainstream, whether it's through different media, different kinds of media. There is, and I think it's definitely, like what you said before, it's definitely this space that's, it's just a space that allows people, that gives people more tools to explore what they want to explore, and perhaps deal with issues that are more difficult and tricky in kind of a realist environment, a realist setting. And it's, I mean, I think it's really hard to create an alternate world or to do world building, actually. So it's an incredible achievement. And also, what was I going to say? I'm not sure. And just because it's about something that's not real does not mean it's not of value or it's not interesting. And I mean, it can just be fun and entertaining and great escapism, and I also like that a lot. But I think I'm finding a lot of books are dealing with perhaps issues such as racism and social issues as well in them, that I think literature just makes it more, SF in particular, just makes it more kind of maybe more poignant, or because you can change the rules, it allows you kind of a bit more freedom to explore them. So yeah, I think the gatekeeping is still there, but the snobbery is still there, which is why I kind of forgot about it for some parts of my life, and which is why I had to think, oh, those cartoons, those are sci-fi actually. And but what you were saying about the internet and how the growth of community on the online forums or social media, that's been a massive phenomenal change and for the better, because there is science fiction, you know, there's fantasy that we can read, but then there's also, then you go online and then you can chat to your friends about it, and there's a community as well. And also about indie publishing and that, how that's encouraging more people to, you know, that's getting more different kinds of books published. Also true of sort of self-publishing, for example, in terms of the Chinese market, in terms of publishing, internet publishing platforms, which have really established themselves, have been just a phenomenal change to remove the barriers, because it's effectively self-publishing, and if you wanted to write a book about that, where in about world where there's no gravity, for example, you know, or everybody is blue, or whatever. I'm probably not very exciting example. But yeah, whatever you want to write, you can write, and you can publish it online, and find if it's good, if it's well written, entertaining, you'll find readers, and that's a direct response to the value of the book. And that's changed, that's encouraged, it's helped so many writers to get published, and then it's changed the way that traditional publishers then what they commission, because they can see the popularity there on these online platforms, and also on social media, how people are talking about these books or these writers, and then they can then maybe kind of get them into print. Or so.
Yeah, I definitely see that has having happened, where huge with indie books that get a gathering get published, but I think if they hadn't got that following, the publishers probably wouldn't have touched them. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah. So I think yes, indie publishing has allowed publishers to see outside the box maybe a bit more, to be more experimental, but also then to kind of say, oh no, these things are actually really popular. I know, well, my book is Irish mythology based, and I know when I was submitting stories, like this is probably a few years ago now, somebody said to me, you know, Irish mythology doesn't sell, like as an adult fantasy genre, you know, it's for kids. And but I think having that indie space and suddenly publishers going, oh, like people are buying books about Chinese mythology or African mythology, you know, maybe readers would like Irish mythology now, you know, it's sort of, yeah, I definitely see that as being one of the biggest and the most positive changes to the fantasy space in the last 5 years. I totally agree with you. Sean, oh boy, has asked a really interesting question here. Oh no, sorry, does somebody say something?
I was going to qualify my thing, because hearing both of you like describe the presence of snobbery made me like rethink my statement. I was like, maybe there is more, you know, part of it is too, we're in different bubbles, right, to some extent. But I wonder too if it's, maybe I'm thinking more about less that there's less snobbery and more that there's more exceptions to point to. Whereas I have to kind of think of the growth of what we call soccer here in the States, so football in the United States, where, you know, if you ask somebody if they like football, they'll say no. But if you ask them if they watch the World Cup, they'll say, oh yeah, I've watched that. You know, and I think maybe when I was initially coming into science fiction fantasy, there were less exceptions I could point to. There was Lord of the Rings, maybe, you know, people outside the genre have read it. Whereas now it's like, do you like fantasy? And they say no. And like, well, have you seen Game of Thrones? They say, yeah. Have you seen X and Y and Z? And they say, yeah. So there's perhaps still some dislike and there's still some snobbery, but maybe I was just recognized or seeing that like there's more counter arguments I have to people, and kind of what Rob was saying, where people maybe don't realize they're consuming fantasy, but they are. Hopefully that leads to something better.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And actually, well, that also kind of leads on to this question Sean has asked about the genres obviously getting much bigger. And are there sub-stigmas within SFF? So are some sub-genres seen as better than others? And so what you're talking about there with the various media that's being shown, it's like people be like, oh yeah, I like Game of Thrones, but I don't like fantasy. Or I like The Handmaid's Tale because that's like literary dystopian fiction, but I don't like fantasy. So is there some subgenres in fantasy that you think are kind of on the pedestal and other ones that like people would still look down upon more? Rob, you go first.
Definitely. Yeah, no, definitely. Like, so one of the things that it honestly confuses me, and I don't have an answer to it, is like Lit RPG, Literature RPG, which is the sort of like idea of computer games, but a book. Anyway, and progression fantasy is there some of the biggest subgenre within the indie sphere at the moment. You know, you're seeing authors like Will White with his Cradle series consistently just like selling more books than any other book in the world, you know, top of the Amazon charts. And now you've got another one, what's it called? He Who Fights With Monsters is now topping the charts every time it releases a new book as well. That one's Lit RPG. And yet, it's still a subgenre within fantasy that traditional publishing refuses to touch. There's no movement from them on it at all. I don't know if that's because it's sort of seen as a lesser genre, subgenre within like the thing, if it's got no sort of like no value or something. But that strikes me as it's got to be some sort of snobbery, because you see the amount of books that these genres are you know, these books within the genres are moving, and it's massive amounts. So I just don't understand why traditional publishing wouldn't be picking these books up, wouldn't be picking this genre up that's obviously selling so much. So I imagine it must be some sort of, snobbery.
Yeah. Okay. What about you, Moses?
I agree. I'm trying to think through that. Yeah, I definitely agree there's stigmas. I'm trying to make a distinction between things that are stigmatized and things that are popular or unpopular. Because I think of romance as a genre. Romance is the biggest, right? Like some of the most best-selling books are romance books. And yet, I mean, I know there's like the thing in romance where romance readers use digital readers at a higher rate because they're afraid to like have their books in public, you know? So there's a stigma there, and it's also still very, very popular. And kind of what you're saying with lit RPG and progressive. And so then it's, I don't know, then it's a question of like, well, how stigmatized is it if everybody's reading? Stigma to who, you know? And so I think there's a difference between gatekeepers to some extent and readers, where readers might not have really a stigma, or enough readers don't have a stigma against it. Or they don't care that there's a stigma against it. Maybe it's there and they just don't care. But yeah, I don't fully have big thoughts on that. It's an interesting relationship.
Yeah. And what about you, Shaiteng? Like, how would you find in like the different subgenres that there would be distinctions or ones that would be seen as better than others?
I don't really have many thoughts about it. I think it's generally SFF genre fiction that has the stigma. I haven't come across anything particular that has more. I'm sure there is, though.
Yeah.
Of different genres.
Well, that's okay. I mean, I think if you read widely within the genre, maybe like you don't see it, or you know, if you're happy to read anything, sometimes it's hard to maybe imagine that other people wouldn't feel that way.
I'm happy to read everything. Quite kind of, as long as it's well written and it's engaging. Because part of my people who read my books are kind of the books on Chinese culture are kind of more interested in Asian culture as opposed to SFF. I do kind of need to consider their point of view. And then there's obviously the people who like SFF that are going to go for the anthologies, but maybe also the. Yeah, so I always say to people, maybe I do need to consider from their point of view, but hopefully there'll be books that, just to give an example of maybe not necessarily stigma, but books that maybe can break the stigma. When we're talking about the expansion of SFF, I'm really happy about it because now people have, at least they've read Three Body Problem, and therefore it's especially including the people who don't usually read sci-fi. So then I can, or they don't usually read Chinese sci-fi. So then that's a starting point for me to talk to them about it. And on the Xianxia Wuxia side, for example, at least people have seen Untamed, and that the book has published, that the TV series is based on, I think, last year. And so people have read that, and that's a starting point for me to talk to them about Chinese fantasy. So
yeah,
those are the kind of book, the Three Body Problem, that kind of crosses the stigma of science fiction, particularly for people in China and maybe some people who don't usually read sci-fi. They kind of see it as some kind of thing on its own, kind of. But it is science fiction, so maybe those books can be the kind of avenues into people reading more. And the stigma becoming less.
Yeah, there's definitely more gateway books, as you're saying, into different subgenres, and It's much easier, to kind of start off conversations these days, definitely. So now we have spoken about kind of where fantasy has been, where we are now. Maybe we'll start thinking about the future. And there's lots of things I kind of want to speak about. One of them is that obviously we've all said that fantasy and science fiction is now kind of bigger than ever. So first of all, is there any negatives? Is there anything that is bad about this? Just as a general thing, I sort of, and it's publishing probably overall, is that it's kind of, books are being sold at like 99p or for free. Is it more difficult to be noticed because there's just so many people in the space? Is that bad? Is that good? What are your thoughts on it? Moses, you go first on that one.
It's a good question. I think to some extent, you know, the more the better, right? The more people have access to things. I'm not going to say that that's bad. I do think there's one potential negative or just thing that the genre and the fandom has to navigate is that when your borders, for lack of a better word, open up, you have to figure out how to include new people, you know? And I think when we talk about snobbery and stigmas, as this thing becomes more popular and grows, we got to figure out how to, I think in any geekdom, there's like bona fides tests where, you know, if they're like, oh, you like Star Wars? Like name 9 planets, or, you know, there's always like some test of like, are you a real member of this space? And these purity tests. And I think we have to figure out what those look like and perhaps do away with some of those as we want to welcome new people in. And so not a negative. I don't think it's negative the more people are coming, but it's potentially negative how some people respond to that. And I think we'll have to navigate that as a collective.
Yeah. Okay. Rob?
Yeah, I mean, speaking obviously from the indie side of things, there is definitely an issue of with the more there is available, it's like there's more noise and it's getting a lot harder to cut through the noise to reach readers, basically. And yeah, one of the biggest problems with that is it's getting harder and harder for new authors to get started. Basically, it's getting more difficult for them to just like be heard over the noise and say, I have a book, which as far as, you know, readers are concerned, we mean that it's harder to find those things that you want. You want this specialist thing. Again, you want the Napoleonic zombies. It's getting more difficult to find that. The books are there, but it's getting hard to find them over the rest of the noise that doesn't actually match. But a lot of that has got to do with being heard over the advertising algorithms. So, you know, it's like if you want to read the specialist book, you say Napoleonic Zombies, you enter that onto to Amazon and the first like 20 hits it's going to give you have got nothing to do with that whatsoever. But that's more of a sort of marketing and advertising issue. But yeah, it's mostly just the only real issue I see with having with the genre expanding the way that it is just being heard over all the noise. And in that sense, it's kind of drowning new authors who they do have something to say, their work is of value, but they just can't be heard, basically.
Yeah. Is that Napoleonic Zombies book a real book? I feel like we should give them a
shot. I have no idea, but now I kind of wish it is, you know? Yeah. We sort of like mentioned it a few times.
I read a book by Genevieve Cogman last week, which is Napoleonic French Revolution Vampires. So we're one step away.
It's Assassin's Creed. If you want to write one, you should write one for them. Potentially, they could exist in the parallel dimension.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely, it's a good book, Rob. You need to start writing it.
Oh, I've got way too many things on my plate already. I'll have to pass it on to somebody else.
I'll have ChatGPT write it. We got it. Easy.
Oh, no. No.
No. Definitely not. If we kind of move on a little bit, we've talked about kind of the rise in some subgenres. And I definitely, I would say, I noticed myself that, say, Grimdark 5 to 10 years ago was like the new subgenre and it exploded. And I think that's maybe not just ranked so highly now. Where do we stay? Like, what new subgenres do you think are going to emerge, or what already established genres are going to make a comeback? So Shui Ting, if I ask that to you first.
I'm going to be quite a short answer for me, I'm afraid. I don't know, and I'm really excited to find out.
Yep, I know. I'm just, I'm asking you to use a crystal ball here, which isn't very fair. But Moses, what about you? What do you think?
I'm similar. I think a lot of innovation in the trad space is driven by innovation in the indie space. And I think indie does kind of drive what comes next. So I think Rob is probably best situated to have a sense of where things might be going. So Rob, no pressure. You got to answer this for all of us.
For genres that have sort of like appeared in the last sort of, I don't know, 3 to 5 years, I think lit RPG and progression are definitely two of the major ones. I think that in the trad sphere, we're getting a lot more like mythological retellings, things like Cersei and those sorts of ones. They sort of, that's, you know, obviously exploded. And I think we're getting a lot more of that, because I think for a lot of the time, what trad is trying to do, I've just realized I've been calling it trad all this time, and I'm fairly certain if Pete McLean is listening to this, he's going to kill me because he insists that it's trade and not trad. I think what they're trying to do a lot of the time is chase trends, basically trying to trace trends a lot more, because they're trying to sell the next big book. They're trying to find the next big Cersei or whatever. Whereas I think indie isn't so much chasing that trend. They're sort of like, as Moses was saying, it's sort of driving the innovation, because they're just willing to experiment, because there isn't the gatekeepers standing in the way saying, no, this sells, so we want more of this. So for indie, it's more sort of an experimental place where anything can go on, you can find anything, basically. As for what might come in the future, I haven't got a clue. I hope that what's going to come around again a bit more is a bit more of the sort of classical fantasy that we get, because I feel like there's not been as much in the way of sort of like classical fantasy in the way of sort of Tolkien-esque type epics. I feel they've kind of like fallen off a bit recently, which I feel is a bit of a shame, because it's still something that I personally want to read. So hopefully we'll see more of that and come back around at some point.
Yeah.
I think, can I add to that? That's a really good point that I was thinking about. I also have a YA book, so I exist somewhat in the YA space, although not maybe as fully as I could. But I noticed there that a lot of the second world fantasies are heavily, heavily rooted in a real world place, which isn't bad, right? But it's different from the fantasies I grew up reading, which are totally, they're rooted in a place, but they're not really, they're just kind of a new place. And so that's a trend that kind of going with what you were saying. I think most trends are somewhat cyclical, things go and come back in style. And I'm interested in seeing that, the next phase of that and what that looks like.
To say briefly that I think a lot of people are writing great horror, and think that's probably going to be quite a big genre for the moment. Not just because I'm curating a horror anthology, but yeah, it's kind of a good time to write horror, and then these will be published soon. And also, I think one genre I'd like to see is, I really love YA, but I would really like to see kind of maybe all books, in particular SFF, kind of featuring kind of older characters. I don't think we see a lot of them in any genre, so perhaps some of those would be good. I've seen a few, I met a few authors who write that, and that's great. They should be more.
yeah, that's an issue close to my heart. A lot of the characters in my books are older, and I think that's important. You know, like, life doesn't exist just in the realm of the young, you know.
Yeah,
and actually older people can be very interesting, you know. Obviously they've lived these lives, have lots going on, and, you know, might have more to offer, kind of a story, than kind of a 17-year-old running around not knowing what to do. But yeah,
I think it's quite often the type of books you sort of get. So you know, the sort of like the younger protagonist sort of thing, they quite often lead more sort of lead into the way, but also sort of like the epic thing where they're going on a quest or whatever. Whereas I think the books that you get with sort of older protagonists, they're usually, at least the ones that I've read, they're usually much more in the sense of, hey, here's a grumpy old person who's been on their adventure, but then here's this whatever it is, incident that drags them back into a new adventure, right, where they have to go save a bunch of young'uns, usually, or something.
Yeah, Kings of the Wild, very much that. Yes, definitely. Do you know, I can't remember who said it, but it was ages ago, and it was saying you find media normally moves towards the opposite of how the real world is. So if the real world, everything's rosy, everything's going well, people like to watch darker stuff on TV or read darker stuff because they're not seeing it in real life, you know, so they're wanting something different. And that when the world is dark and bleak and grim, people gravitate towards kind of entertainment that is happier and more of an escape. Because I definitely feel that. Like, I think Travis Beldry's book, Legends and Lattes, you know, what a book to come out. And I think kind of it makes sense that that came out after a kind of global pandemic, and when the news is awful. I almost like literally can't watch the news anymore. It's too bad. And so yeah, that's my prediction, is that we're going to get some more like cozy fantasy, and I also think back to those old school epic fantasies, like heroic fantasies that aren't just maybe so grim or realistic, like a bit more sort of have happier outcomes.
What I was thinking, like Lord of the Rings. I mean, I think that, you know, that's a sort of like, it's an epic fantasy, yeah, but it's very much sort of full of hope, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
So I think we're quite likely to see more of that come around because, yeah, much like cozy fantasy, it's that sort of idea of, it's about hope rather than, you know, the world that we're living in, which kind of feels like, hey, have another apocalypse.
The idyllic fantasies and then the really grim stories that you kind of feel great for getting through, coming out of it in the end. So there's a bit of both.
Yeah.
And I wondered too, if I've talked to some other authors of previously like colonized nations, and I think we've discussed the tendency toward the grim, kind of what Shui Ting was saying, like it almost wouldn't feel accurate to have like an idyllic situation, but the hope comes from getting through it, right? The hope comes from the fact that in the end, I mean, maybe everybody's dead, but there, you know, there's some element of the future that could be brighter.
I definitely think that that's I think why so many people like fantasy and science fiction, is that you can have the bleak journeys, but they're not real journeys, so you can handle the darkness more. But then also that means, because you've had that dark story, that the hope is all that much brighter. And so then you can feel really good, even though you've maybe read something that's quite hard-hitting, you can feel good at the end of it. Whereas I think if you read something that is very dark in real life, it can be quite unsettling, you know, no matter what the outcome is, because it's based in real life, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it's kind of more horrific if you know that it really happened rather than it's made up, basically.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right. Okay. So the other thing that I was going to talk about is something that the internet has been awash with the last couple of weeks, is AI. and the emergence of that, which I will just come straight out and say, I hate it. I hate that this is emerging. I don't think it's good. But what are your thoughts on it? Moses, you go first.
I'm going to have, I think, a controversial take, especially for a writer. You know, I look at my parents and how they react to new technologies, and that is my knee-jerk reaction to AI. And so I had to like sit and think about it, of like, is this because I'm old or is this because it's bad, you know? And I think to some extent it's because it's bad, but also, you know, I'm working on a couple of books right now, and I think about like what publishing looks like from the eyes of a publisher and how that experience isn't too different from my experience of ChatGPT, where I sit down and I say, I want a book that does this, then I hit enter, and then some other intelligence does it. And so I think of authors like James Patterson or some of these authors who essentially function as content mills already. They just do it with human labor. And to be fair, that's human ingenuity and human creativity and human craft. But when I think of the socialist in me and the means of production and who owns what, I'm like, to some extent, you know, as these technologies evolve, they're somewhat inevitable. It's not something any of us can put a halt on. And so I think, yeah, you know, if there is, and I don't think they're divorced from craft. I've seen, like, I know Midjourney is a really popular one that generates images, and I've seen images that I generate with Midjourney, which are trash because I don't have an imagistic brain. I don't understand how camera angles and lighting work, versus a professional who can generate something very specific because they understand, they have craft knowledge that I don't have. And so I do think there will still be, assuming these things are inevitable, it's just something we have to interface with, I do think there's still a skill set required to get the maximum results from them. And I think it's almost, good or bad, it's almost, realistically, I think that's a direction that will have to be reckoned with, especially in indie publishing, I think, where, I mean, to some extent, the gatekeepers of trade publishing are currently actively of trying to weed it out. But I think in spaces where readers are interfacing with works directly, I mean, there's already AI children's books that have been published and are doing pretty well. And so, you know, I mean, it seems an eventuality that we got to figure out.
Yeah. What about you, Rob?
I agree that I don't think it's going anywhere. I can't see it as anything but a sort of terrible thing. I can see that AI can be kind of useful in many ways, especially in sort of like, because you already see it. I mean, a word processor is basically an AI.
Yeah.
So I can see it in that sort of sense of trying to help an author improve their craft, sure. But I don't see how, like, how can a book written by a computer have any subtext? How can it provide anything actual meaningful beyond just, hey, here's the words, it's making a story? There's no meaning behind it because there's no driving force behind the creativity, is the way that I see it. And I might be completely off base. I've never used ChatGPT. I don't entirely know how it all works. But I do know that there are already authors. My camera's going. Hello. There are already authors, established authors out there who are starting to use AI to produce massive amounts of books. You know, they're sort of like saying, oh, I can produce like 400 books a month. And what that's going to do is it's going to increase the noise, which is bringing it back to, it's going to make it much harder for especially new authors who don't already have a name, who don't already have a fan base, a readership, to be heard, to get their books out to people, because it's just going to be flooded with AI written books, basically.
Yeah.
That's kind of a large issue that I see. But, you know, it may lead to more of an upswing back to traditional publishing, being that, yeah, people are wanting to read something with a bit more sort of quality, something with a bit more meaning behind it, so they'll go to somewhere where they know that they're not going to get this AI written book. But yeah, I am old, and I am against AI because damn those machines.
Yeah. I It does worry me. Like, I know 5 years ago, was it AI started to play chess, and the top chess players were adamant that, like, it would never be able to beat them, and now they can't beat the computers. Yeah. The computers beat them all the time. And so for me, it's like a worry that those kind of programs are going to get significantly better quite quickly, and that the content that they will produce will be of a reasonable quality that readers won't know. And, you know, I think with really good literature, there's stuff about it that is like special or thought-provoking. But I think for a lot of stuff, I think an AI program could probably replicate enough that it would be passable, which is, it's something that worries me. It worries me in the indie community as well, because I think, as you say, the noise will increase. But it does worry me that like mainstream publishing would take that in as well, which would just ultimately be bad for authors. You know, anytime there's a technology advance, it's normally people who miss out on opportunities. You know, they're replaced. So it's something, it's definitely something that worries me. What do you think about it? Shui-Ting, have you any thoughts on it?
I think it's worrying too, as being AI is being used for creativity. They are very useful in other areas of society, and certainly in Asia, China in particular, we're seeing them kind of in everyday life, kind of in restaurants or helping to run kind of old people's homes and deliver parcels. And that's great. They're great for those things. But and I do, some of my editors do kind of sometimes put text through quickly through these translation software things that come out, and then they could just, so they could quickly get the meaning. And while I think that in the future, maybe they can help break barriers down between people who speak different languages, I'm certainly not going to actively help those software, develop those abilities, because that would be like Turkey celebrating Christmas, you know. It's one of the reasons why I suppose my editors and publishers kind of do really value the curating and editing side of my work. So when I write about the stories and when I give my insight and perspective into that, I think the creativity and the skill and the insights of writers, that's not something that AI could ever replace or assimilate. So it is worrying, but it's not that there are things that they can't do, I think.
Okay.
I think maybe in the foreseeable future, I mean, it's, I think to some extent, the way technology progresses, it's kind of impossible to anticipate what 25 years from now will look like. I mean, I didn't, you know, in 2000, the iPad didn't exist. Like, things progress so quick. So I think for the foreseeable future, it's less of a replacement for authors and more of a, I could see it being more of a tool. I mean, I agree that they're not creative, right? AIs don't create, they compile to some extent, or they predict. And so the ability to generate novel concepts and explore them is still, I think, very human. However, I think in terms of productivity, when we talk about AI, and I will say there's a slight, like, I worry about class snobbery to some extent, because I think typically technology is very celebrated when it replaces jobs that, you know, in America, at least in the United States, there's this whole discussion of coal mining and like coal energy production. And coal miners are very worried about clean energy because it means they're going to lose their jobs. And I think most of America is like, well, whatever, you know, figure it out because this is good and we want this. And so I worry about being a bit of a class snob when it comes to AI, because my position is threatened. Technology is bad, right? Whereas it will increase productivity a lot. And I have, maybe then I think my job then is to figure out how I can use it to create, to produce, to accelerate my productivity and not necessarily replace my creative process. Now, I'm hoping that's where the field goes, is that it doesn't replace creativity, it just enhances productivity.
Okay.
I do know some authors who are using it in a sort of like, already using it in a similar sense to that, where they're sort of like, if there's a, you know, say a description of like a city, rather than sitting there and slaving over, oh, here's my description of a city, they'll be like, give me Arabic city description, and you know, it will generate a couple of paragraphs, which is then something they can just insert in almost to say, this is what the city looks like.
Oh, I hate that thing.
Like, I know, I hate it a lot.
It just like hurts.
Feels like, but it's then removing the author part of the job, doesn't it? It's like, so why are you doing this? No,
yeah.
I know. That is me. I do completely understand your point, Moses, about that kind of class snobbery, where it's like, because you're a writer, that you're like an elite, and therefore you can't be replaced, but you're quite happy for other jobs throughout the world to have been replaced. And and I think that's something that we need to think of as well. You know, technology is brilliant and has changed our lives, and maybe, you know, we need to think about it not just in terms of how it affects us positively, but also how it affects other people negatively. And that's a very interesting conversation. But just seeing as we're talking about SFF, I hate it.
I think there needs to be some sort of protections or sort of legislation put in place, to be honest. I think like the first one that would need to go into place is something like, if a book is written by an AI, it needs to be stated, like on the product page or whatever, this is written by an AI. But then, of course, that would need to come, I guess, from the courts down, really, wouldn't it?
I mean, I know there's questions of ownership, right? Like, if I produce something in AI, do I own it, or does the company that built the AI device own it? And maybe that's a place for legislation. I don't even know if this is good or bad, but right, if the AI company owns some element of it, to where an author can't just like completely create a work in AI and say it's theirs. You need to either edit substantially, or, you know, like there's got to be something. You really do have to use your author creativity. You can't just become a factory, essentially, just churn out books.
Yeah. And I suppose there is like a limit to how much people want books to be churned out. You know, you can only read so quickly. So ultimately, it's, you know, even if you could churn out a book a week, maybe, you know, there wouldn't be enough people to read your books if you did that, and that would kind of cause a leveling out as well.
I think on one hand, there is a lot of choice for people who want to read, different people want to read different things. Then on the other hand, there is too much to read, too little time. And despite our writing, so many artists writing about AI and how they can take over our lives and how they kind of take over the world, and, you know, we are still kind of introducing them everywhere. It's quite ironic. I mean, it's great that they can do jobs that are dangerous for humans to do, but we're still kind of, unfortunately, seen to, you know, they're still kind of replacing humans, perhaps, where they, there could be a person doing that job.
It makes me
I'd like to say, let's write more stories or publish more stories about warning people of these things. but we seem to be doing what those stories say not to do. Certainly, I'm seeing experiments by Chinese writers, because the technology there is developing very quickly, kind of collaborating with AI. They're stating quite clearly they're collaborating with an AI to write the story, or collaborating with a company to write a series of short stories about, based on AI and how humans interact with them. That's quite interesting from a kind of humanist point of view, not totally different from them being the authors or ghostwriting books for humans or anything like that.
What you were just saying reminds me of like the idea that humans we warn ourselves of the things that will destroy us and then do it anyway. Like I know the word atom, at least I remember hearing a story, the word atom comes from like the Greek word atomos, which means like indivisible or uncuttable, which of course we eventually like divided the atom and, you know, we got what we got. We've since created nuclear weapons. And so maybe we do kind of warn ourselves and just don't heed these warnings.
Yeah.
Feel like book or a TV show is there to warn some, you know, warn humanity, don't do this, there's always going to be some person who's like, this is a guidebook on what to do next.
Yeah. We're like one bad decision away from the Matrix coming true, and we'll be like human farmed for energy by the AI.
Yeah. I know, I'm more thinking like we're sort of like Terminator 2, we're Sarah Connor, just like artist of Sarah Connor, just like, stop it! Like on the chain fence and everything.
Yeah. Okay, so we're kind of getting to an hour and 20 minutes. So somebody actually just asked a question, and it was about somebody who is trying to write now, and they're talking about the query trenches, and that they are being told to kind of pitch their books, and who are they pitching to, and kind of, I suppose, maybe what advice you would have there is that, is it getting easier to pitch just because there's more comparisons, or like how did you find that yourselves?
I don't have a lot to add here, being indie. I do have an agent who has sort of like told me this is what Trad is currently selling, this is what they're looking for, but then he also said to me, just write what you want to write, and if we can sell the book, we will. If not, you'll self-publish it, go for it.
Yeah. It's hard because it's like they want you to write kind of what's true to you and what's authentic, but there are certainly templates and books that they want you to kind of to write about because they sell well. I just think for myself, I wrote the book I wanted to write, and I didn't really think too much about who would read it until afterwards. And that's probably a terrible advice, but I wouldn't know how else to write.
I really agree with that. To write the book that you feel you need to write, and then there will be people who want to read it, and maybe your agent or publishers would work with you to adjust the book a bit. But always, I think writers should always write what they feel like they need to, rather than what are the different elements that are most popular? Let's put them together and write something. I mean, I've spoken to people who've done that, and it's not been a great result. And the books I've edited or translated really feel like, and I because I always talk to the authors, and I write a commentary after the story, and I can see what inspired them and how they've come to write the story, and it's always been really fascinating. And really feel like it's really come from their experiences or thoughts or, you know, life experiences, and that's really great. I think there's a lot more avenues to publishing now than trade trad. I'm not sure what the terms are, because indie is trade as well, right? Because they do sell their books, but then the boundaries are not so clear now, because some indies are quite large publishers, but then you also have really small publishers who are indies who work probably on a very different model. But you have the big publishers, then you have the smaller publishers, indie publishers as well, who kind of send quite regular call out for submissions on a wider range of things, and then they're more open to more different kinds of writers. And also you have online publishing and magazines as well. For what used to be magazines, but now are online, kind of SFF platforms. So maybe go for like some of those first, and then try and then go for books. There are so many different avenues, and sometimes these communities and publishers, they micro publish things on social media as well, like things like Weibo, which is like the Chinese Twitter, where you can post articles and pieces, they get published there, the writers, and then they get collected in an anthology. So there are many avenues.
I think no matter what you write, there's somewhere to publish it. I suppose specifically, that there's, like, as you say, there's magazines, there's small presses, there's indie, there are the bigger traditional publishing houses. I think you have to write what you love. And I think, I mean, really, there should be something to comp it to. You know, I comped my book to Circe because it was Greek mythology and I was Irish mythology. And they're very different stories, but it's just to give it a sort of a broad theme that might be similar, or a kind of readership base that you think it might appeal to. But I wouldn't worry so much about that. I would really honestly just write the book you want to write, because fads change, readerships move, and if you're writing to a current trend, you might find by the time your book's finished that trend is like over and then you've got a book that's kind of not seen as being very sellable, whereas I think if you're passionate about something, then that will always shine through. What about you, Moses? Any thoughts on that question?
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think write what you love is important. I'll add a caveat that write what you love, as long as you have good taste. And I don't mean like good in like, you know, I mean, it kind of, it's somewhat of a reading question, right? It's if you're reading contemporary literature and you're reading in any space, whether it's lit or the journals or traditional, like whatever, you understand the conversations going on in that space. You understand the aesthetic. And so I think if you're in a space, you can write what you love and it'll be influenced by things that are also publishable. Whereas I've known writers and I've read manuscripts where somebody's just kind of really removed from publishing and they're writing what they love. But the presumption of like there will be other readers who love it is tough because they don't even love what other readers love. So they're really outside this space. And so I think if you feel that way, and it happens, increase your reading experience, like really dive into some space and read it, and then try to create. And I think you'll find that what you love aligns more with what's publishable.
Yeah, I think so. I read a lot, so that didn't even occur to me that people would try to write stuff without really reading in the genre. But yes, that's obviously a thing. If you want to write like a romantasy, then you know you kind of need to read what's popular and what's been popular. And even if for you to think things that you don't like, things that you don't want to do, that's also useful, right? So when you come to write your book, you don't maybe follow tropes that you didn't enjoy yourself. Definitely reading in your genre is very important. Okay, so I think I'm gonna round up now and let everybody get on with the rest of their days. And I think just to summarize, where AI is taking over and we don't know what subgenres are gonna be popular in the future. So. but we've had a great time talking about everything and just talking about our love of the genre in general, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Like I think the growth in the genre has been amazing. I think it's going to continue to grow, and so I think, you know, there's a lot of opportunities for writers maybe who are watching this who want to get into the space. And there's a lot of opportunities for readers. You know, I'm sure there's some people who are watching this that have probably heard of a few subgenres that they didn't know of before. And so I'd always encourage that, you know, there's so many subgenres and there's so many books being published that there really is books out there for everybody. So thank you everybody for coming and talking to me and giving your opinions, and have a lovely day.